The message on this tape is entitled, God Meant It for Good. It is the fourth in Bishop John W. Howe's series, In the Beginning.
Let me read to you from chapter 27 of the book of Genesis. This is part of the story that we're going to be reviewing today and try to put it into context in just a moment. Genesis 27, when Isaac was old, and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called his elder son Esau and said to him, My son, and he answered, Here I am. He said, See, I am old, I do not know the day of my death. Now then take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Then prepare for me savory food, such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may bless you before I die. Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, I heard your father say to your brother Esau, Bring me game and prepare for me savory food to eat, that I may bless you before the Lord before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my word as I command you. Go to the flock and get me two choice kids, so that I may prepare from them savory food for your father, such as he likes. And you shall take it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies. I suspect that most everyone is familiar, at least in a general kind of a way, with the outline of our story. But it may be that we're more familiar with certain parts. Certain parts, of course, are extremely vivid to us. They're fun. Some of them are funny. But I want to just recap it, kind of try to put this into a larger context for us and bring us up to the story of Joseph today. And back up, we looked at Abraham a couple of weeks ago. Abraham is the progenitor of a covenant family, and really from Abraham, three great world families, three great religious families, all trace their origins back to the set of promises that God gave to Abraham. Jews, Christians, Mohammedans alike all see Abraham as the father of the faith. And we thought about the threefold promise that God gave to Abraham. If you will follow me, I'm going to lead you from the land of Ur to a place you've never seen, to a new place altogether. And I'm going to give to you, number one, the land itself, beautiful land, land flowing with milk and honey. Interesting footnote to the story, Abraham never really received that land. It came to his descendants. Abraham, he dwelt on it for a while, in and out somewhat, but the only part of the promised land that he ever really himself inherited was the burial cave, where he and his wife eventually were buried. But I will give to you, to your descendants, to your family, to this covenant people, the land. Number two, innumerable descendants, and speaking in very extravagant terms, the Lord says, as many as the stars of the heaven or the sand of the seashore. And most especially, number three, an offspring, one of your descendants, through whom or in whom all the nations of the world will be blessed. I remind you of that. I just want you to keep in mind one of the threads that I've tried to articulate here. One of the things that holds this whole saga together is the concept of God choosing. And I made the comment that when he chooses somebody for blessing, it's not just that I can hold that blessing to myself, but that I become a vehicle of blessing to others. And we see that in God's choosing of Abraham. I'm choosing you, and you will be blessed. But it's so that, through your offspring, all the other nations of the world can be blessed. Why did God choose the Jewish people to be his own covenant people, his special people? It wasn't so that they could hold that specialness as an exclusive prerogative, but that through them, the other nations would also be blessed. And then we saw that Abraham's son, Isaac, whose very name means laughter, it's funny, it's a joke, it's God's little joke, that at age 100, Isaac should be the father of a son. At age 90, Sarah should give birth to a son named Isaac. Isaac is the child. through whom all of these promises about innumerable descendants and that one special descendant can come to pass. And Isaac is asked of God. God asks that Isaac be offered back to him. And of course, he is miraculously, wondrously restored. There's a ram caught in the thicket. Abraham faltered in his faith en route to Isaac being born, and produces a sort of a half son, a half brother at least, of Isaac by the name of Ishmael, and there's conflict between them all the way through their life. He's envied and hated by his half brother Ishmael. That's where we left off the story. And just very quickly to bring us up to this point, Isaac grows up, marries Rebekah, his cousin, who has an older brother by the name of Laban. Isaac and Rebekah have twin sons, Esau and Jacob. And another thread that we're going to see all the way running through this story is the fact that typically, generally speaking, God's principal blessing comes to the firstborn. But repeatedly, God violates that principle himself and brings the blessing to another. And that's at the very heart of the Esau and Jacob story. Esau is the elder, and he should have gotten the blessing. He has the birthright, being the firstborn. They're twins, but he's the first one born. And he should have had the birthright to the patriarchal blessing, the lion's share of everything. But it turns out that he fails to value his birthright, and he ends up giving it away to his younger brother Jacob for a mess of pottage, for a bowl of stew, if you will. Esau is a big, strapping, hairy outdoorsman type, a hunter, a man who goes and bags his prey and brings it back. Jacob, the younger of the twins, is a deceitful, crooked, sneaky, conniving mama's boy. You need to get that very clearly in mind. Strangely enough, God's favor falls on Jacob, and you say, why in the world would that be so? Why does he overlook Esau, who didn't do anything wrong, there wasn't any moral culpability, and choose Jacob, whose very name means supplanter, dirty sneak thief? Why? Well, I've already given you half of the answer, because Esau didn't value it. He didn't value his birthright. Imagine selling away your birthright for a bowl of soup. Came back hungry one day, and his brother was cooking lunch, and he sees this stew, and he says, oh, I want some. And Jacob says, give me your birthright, and you got it. Now, I don't care how hungry you are. That's a pretty expensive deal. Esau lost it because he didn't value it. And let's be very clear about it. Jacob was sneaky and conniving, but there's one good thing about Jacob, and it runs all the way through his story. Jacob won't settle for less than the best. He won't settle for less than the best. He is willing ultimately to deceive his own father in order to get the blessing. But he won't settle for less than the best. And mind you, when we think about that story, the one that I just read, and we're going to get into it just a little bit more, he had already gotten the birthright. So it was by right his to be blessed at his father's hands. He refuses to settle for less than his father's blessing. And much later, the other story that we remember about him is that he refuses to settle for less than God's blessing. Remember that strange story about Jacob wrestling with the angel of God all night? And he says, I won't let you go till you bless me. I could preach a good sermon about that. You know, if we just wanted to kind of stop there and dwell upon it. Think about, on the one hand, giving away, letting somebody take for a mess of pottage your very birthright as a child of God. Think about that. If you don't value what God says is valuable, you may end up losing it. And on the other hand, being willing to wrestle with God until you get his best. Quite a sermon there. Jacob is his mother's son. It's interesting how the language right here in chapter 27, Isaac says, "my son," to Esau. Rebekah says, "my son," to Jacob. Did you notice that? She doesn't say, "my other son," she says, "your brother." See? And Rebekah sees that the blessing is about to be passed, and she says to Jacob, "You go out and prepare some, prepare yourself, and I'll prepare some stew. You bring me a lamb from your flock, and I'll fix it as if it were wild venison or wild game. And I want you to strap onto the backs of your hands and the back of your neck some lamb's wool, some hair. Your father is so blind that he won't be able to tell except by feeling whether you are his son." And so she participates. She initiates the deception. Put on Esau's robe because it has the smell of being out there in the wild, and you'll come back and deceive him. And he does all that, deceives his father. Verse 18, he went into his father and said, "My father," and he said, "Here am I. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game so that you may bless me." Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." How about that? And Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near that I may feel you, my son, and know whether you really are my son Esau or not." So Jacob went up to his father Isaac, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." "You liar." He said, bring me the game. "Bring it to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it to him and he ate, and he brought him wine and he drank. His father Isaac said, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, "Ah, the smell of my own son. It's like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." Jacob lies and cheats and deceives, but he gets the blessing. His mother says, "You better get out of here. Esau is going to be plenty angry with you. Go to my brother Laban until things cool down around here." You go back and read this story in its entirety. I'm just going to hit the highlights. Laban, I got to tell you, is the godfather of deceit. Okay? I mean, if Jacob was in sort of a small town operator, he is about to meet the Marlon Brando of deceit. Laban has two daughters, Rachel, who it says is beautiful and lovely, but she's the younger. Leah, again, firstborn, who has weak eyes. I don't know what that means exactly. Cross-eyed? Wall-eyed? Droop-eyed? Nearsighted? Red-eyed? I don't know what it means. She had weak eyes. She was not a very attractive girl. And Laban says, "Yes, you may have the hand of my younger daughter, Rachel. You've got to work for me for 7 years." And Jacob agrees. Genesis 29, verse 20 says, "They seemed to him but a few days because of the love he had for her." You can hear the violins in the background. On the wedding day, Laban dresses Leah, the firstborn, in full gown and veil. And the next morning when they get up, Jacob awakens to find that he's wedded to the wrong girl. Just want to underscore poetic justice here. Poetic justice. The man who dressed up as his brother to receive the blessing that should have been his brother's, now finds that his wife has been dressed up as her sister in order to retain her blessing. Get it? Laban says, well, you can have both of them. He says, I didn't want Leah, thank you very much. You can have both of them. You got Leah. It'll just be another 7 years. And Jacob serves another 7 years. Although he has both brides immediately, he serves another 7 years to fulfill this promise to Laban. That brings us up to the point of the children of Israel. Jacob, whose name, as I said, literally means supplanter, literally means sneaky thief, wrestles with the angel of God until he gets the blessing, and in getting the blessing, his name is changed to Israel, one who strives with God. Whenever there is a change in character in someone in Scripture, it is usually accompanied by a change in name. Or vice versa, if there's a change in name, it usually signals a change in character or a change in status in some way. Abram, exalted father, becomes Abraham, father of a multitude. Jacob, dirty sneak thief, becomes Israel, one who wrestles with God until he receives the blessing. And so from this point on, we're going to be talking about the children of Israel. But I want to just give you quickly what that really meant. In chapters 29 and 30 of the book of Genesis, it's spelled out. And I just put it up here on the sheet. Very quickly, Jacob, who becomes Israel, now has these two sisters that he's married to, both of them, Leah the elder, Rachel the younger. Both of them have maids that attend them. Leah's maid is named Zilpha. Rachel's maid is named Bilhah. Beautiful names, aren't they? Now begins the parenting of 12 brothers, each of whom becomes, in turn, the progenitor of a clan or a tribe. The 12 tribes of Israel come directly from this father and these four women. A psychiatrist would have a field day. I mean, I just want, some of you know this as well as I do, but some of you may never have put this quite together. I just want you to get just the surface dynamics of what's going on. Jacob, Israel, loves Rachel. That's his bride as far as he's concerned. He got Leah thrown in as extra baggage, all right? He has relationships with both of them, but Rachel is barren, produces no children. And Leah produces four sons, one after another, in very short order. First one is Reuben. Reuben, see, a son, is what his name literally means. See, a son, aren't you pleased with me? Well, sort of, but I really wish it were Rachel's instead. Simeon is number two. The Lord has heard. Has he? Whose prayer has he heard? Leah's? Rachel's? Not Rachel's. Jacob Israel's? I'm not sure. Third son is Levi, which means joined. We have been joined together, and here is the byproduct. And the fourth is Judah, whose name is praise. Four sons in a row, and all this while, Rachel, the beloved, is barren. And she's seeing her older sister becoming increasingly fruitful, growing family, sons which are valued in this day. Far above, far in excess perhaps of what they should have been, but sons are the valued ones, and my older sister has four of them and I don't have any. So she comes up with a brilliant idea, same idea that Sarah had when she was barren. Go into my maid and father sons by her, and I will consider them to be my sons. And Jacob Israel says, that sounds like a good idea to me. And so he goes in and visits Bilhah, and she has a son named Dan, which means he judged, and another son named Naphtali, which means wrestled, wrestled with God, also wrestled with Bilhah. Leah says, if Rachel's going to do that, I can do the same thing. I got a maid too. Hey, Jake, come see Zilpha for a while. Jacob thinks that's a good idea. Produces a seventh son. Gad. Which means good fortune. And an eighth son, Asher, which means happy. I'm not sure who the happy one was at this point. Well, Jacob has not left off relationships with any of these four ladies. He continues meeting Leah every now and then, and she has two more sons. Issachar is number nine, and Zebulun. Issachar meaning my reward. Beginning to get the dynamics here? You send him into your maid, I'll send him into my maid. You want to know who God is pleased with? I got seven sons so far. How are you doing? This is my reward. You understand that every time you call somebody by name, if their name means something, you're saying, my reward, come here. Zebulun, which means honor. I'm the honored one. He may prefer you, my dear, but God is clearly blessing me. Look at this. About this time, it says in chapter 30, verse 22, God remembered Rachel and opened her womb. And finally, Joseph is born. He's the star of our show today, but I needed to put it into context. After 10 other sons have been born to three other mothers, along comes Joseph. He's my bride's firstborn, says Jacob Israel. He's my firstborn, as far as I'm concerned. Thank you very much. And Jacob Israel begins to treat Joseph, whose name means he adds, begins to treat Joseph as if he were the firstborn. How do you think old Reuben feels about that one? And all the others. I mean, you want to talk about sibling rivalry. You have never seen anything like the sibling rivalry overtaking this family. I took the title of this talk, Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, from the play that has been around for the last few years by the same title. And it, of course, takes its name from the translation in the King James Version that what Jacob gave as a gift to Joseph was a coat of many colors. And that's how you all remember it, right? We drew that in Sunday school with our beautiful rainbow-colored coat. It turns out that's a very poor translation. I hate to disappoint you, but what it really means is a coat with long sleeves, which is more significant than you might have thought at first. Stop and think about it. Who would have the privilege of wearing long sleeves? It's the person who doesn't have to get his hands dirty, right? Everybody else has no sleeves or very short sleeves or maybe no shirt. They're out there in the field. They're out there tending the flocks. They're planting crops or whatever the work is. They're out there sweaty and dirty, but the one with the long sleeves... Oh. You get the picture. Turn with me to chapter 37. Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien in the land of Canaan. And this is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other children because he was the son of his old age, and he had made him a long robe with sleeves. Didn't have to do much hard work out there with his brothers. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Once Joseph had a dream, and when he had told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream that I dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field, and suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright. Then your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brothers said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. Had another dream and told it to his brothers, saying, "Look, I've had another dream. You didn't like the other one? See how you like this one. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me." But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked him and said to him, "What kind of dream is this that you have had? Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow to the ground before you?" So his brothers were jealous of him. But his father kept the matter in mind and pondered it. Those of you who were here last fall as we were looking at the book of Revelation may remember that it's the very same imagery that comes in the book of Revelation about the moon and the sun and the stars being surrounding the woman who is Israel. This is the people of Israel. These are the children of Israel. But I need you to see what the relationships were between them. Eventually, just to complete the picture, a good deal later, there is a 12th son born, Benjamin, whose name really is a play on Benoni, which means son of my sorrow. Benjamin is born as his mother is dying, and that's really another part of the story, but I'm getting ahead of myself. His brothers hate him. He gives them plenty of reason for doing so. He visits his brothers who are hard at work, and they decide to do away with him. Their first thought is to kill him, but then Reuben prevails and he says, let's not kill him. Let's sell him to some merchants en route to Egypt. Presumably he eventually will be taken care of by them in one way or another, but at least his blood won't be on our hands. He's purchased as a slave by Potiphar, a captain of the guard of Pharaoh, and eventually he's put in charge of all of Potiphar's holdings. Potiphar's wife at one point tries to seduce the young man Joseph, and when he refuses, she accuses him of having tried to seduce her. He's clapped into jail. Once again, he attains leadership even in jail, and eventually he's put in charge of all the other prisoners. After a while, the baker and the butler of Pharaoh himself are also jailed, and one night they both have dreams, and God gives the correct interpretation to Joseph. The butler is going to be restored to his position, and the baker is going to be beheaded in 3 days' time, and that happens. The baker is beheaded. The butler is restored. Joseph tells the butler, "Please remember me." But he doesn't, not for a number of years. Eventually, Pharaoh himself has a dream, in fact, two dreams. First dream he has, he sees 7 thin cows coming up and devouring 7 fat cows, only they don't get any fatter. Second dream, 7 blighted ears of corn eat up 7 good ears. None of his wise men can interpret these dreams, very bizarre dreams. And suddenly the butler remembers that fellow back there in the jail who a couple of years ago correctly interpreted my dream and the dream of the baker as well. Pharaoh sends for Joseph. Joseph interprets the dreams, and you remember that part. Joseph tells him 7 good years will be followed by 7 bad years. And the fact that you dreamed it twice means that it's doubly certain. So start preparing now during the 7 good years for those 7 lean years which are to come. Pharaoh puts Joseph in charge of the whole nation's agricultural production and stockpiling. And eventually famine comes. The 7 years do hit with severity. And not only Egypt, but the whole surrounding territory is in terrible, terrible strife. People start coming to Pharaoh and coming to his right-hand man, guess who? Joseph, hoping that they can provide some food in this time of famine. And eventually, who should come but Joseph's own brothers, who haven't seen him for years? He tests them repeatedly to determine whether they've changed at all. They have. He provides for them abundantly. And finally, they and their families and their servants and their ancient father, Jacob, who thought his son was long dead, move down to Egypt and spend the next 5 centuries there, their children and their children's children. They stay in the land of Goshen in the northern part of Egypt until the time of the Exodus. Two things, and stringing all that together. Look at chapter 39, verse 23, the last verse of chapter 39. The chief jailer paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care. In other words, he didn't worry about it. When Joseph was in the jail, in charge over all the other prisoners, the chief jailer didn't worry about anything that he had entrusted to Joseph's care because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. There's a very famous Bible called the Great Bible of 1539. The Great Bible of 1539 translates that verse this way. The Lord was with Joseph, that lucky fellow. Now, just step back from this incredible story. Joseph, born into a family of thieves. They've been robbing from each other. They've been deceiving each other. Thieves and liars who have tried repeatedly to outswindle each other. He's born into a household with 4 women competing with each other for his father's favor. 10 elder brothers who hate him and try to destroy him. He's sold into slavery. He's falsely charged with attempted rape. He is thrown into prison and he's abandoned there. The Lord was with him, the lucky fellow. The Lord was with him. And even there, whatever he did prospered. If he's in prison, he becomes the chief of the prisoners. If he's a slave in Potiphar's house, he becomes the overseer of all the other slaves and the master of the household under his master, Potiphar. Are you able to dare to believe that the Lord is with you no matter what your circumstances? Are you able to accept the hand that is dealt you, not believing that it's blind fate, but that somehow behind even the awful things that happen, even the terrible miscarriages of justice that may come your way, the Lord is the dealer, and the Lord is with you, and can turn that into an opportunity? It would be so easy. The astonishing thing to me about Joseph's story is that it didn't turn all to anger and hatred and bitterness on his part. But somehow in the midst of this unbelievable, I mean, if you made this a soap opera, you'd never get it on television. I mean, nobody would ever believe this thing. And yet Joseph somehow in the midst of that is able to go on trusting the Lord, believing that the Lord is with him. The Lord knows what he's doing, and the Lord prospers whatever he does. The Lord was with him. that lucky fellow. And look at how it ends. Years later, he becomes Pharaoh's vice regent. He is in charge of virtually the whole economy of the land of Egypt, not only saving that nation by careful planning and forethought, but able to save surrounding peoples as well, including his own family, his own brothers, who put him there in the first place. Turn to chapter 50. This is really the end of the book of Genesis, the end of Joseph's story, but what a wonderful note on which to conclude. You remember how they come to him, and as I said, he tests them and tests them, and it eventually turns out that he says, well, leave Benjamin here as my slave, and you go on back home. And they say, oh no, please, no, we can't do that to our father a second time. We were responsible for the death of his favorite son. They don't even realize they're talking to their own brother. We can't. Benjamin has become his favorite son in the absence of Joseph. We can't be responsible for leaving Benjamin behind. Joseph sees that their character has been changed. They're wonderfully reconciled at this point. But when Jacob, Israel, dies, Joseph's brothers, his elder brothers, fear for themselves. And says in verse 18, his brothers also wept, fell down before him, and said, we are here as your slave. I'm sorry, I didn't go far enough. Verse 15, realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers said, what if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong we did to him? So they approached Joseph, saying, your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now, therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him, and said, we are here as your slaves. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. Have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones. In this way he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. You meant it for evil. You meant it. I know you meant it for evil. I know what you were like at the time. I know what you were up to. You were trying to do away with me. You sold me into slavery because you didn't want the guilt of having killed me yourself, but you fully expected it would lead to my death. You disinherited me. You treated me despicably, far beyond the fact that I was the favored son of whom you were jealous. You meant it for evil. But God meant it for good. God meant it for good. God has brought great good out of what you tried to do. He's brought good in my life. He's brought good in the life of the whole nation of Egypt. And now he's returned good to you. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. Are we able? Do you dare in your own life, in your own circumstances, no matter who's doing you wrong? Do you dare to see the hand of God behind those circumstances, eager and willing to use those very circumstances to produce good, perhaps where it's least expected? The Lord was with Joseph, that lucky fellow. And even though others, even though loved ones, even though family meant to do him evil, God allowed it to happen for good. It's the very same message as we saw last week in the life of Job, isn't it? On a different scale, much different scale, but exactly the same thing. How can a good God allow all this horror, all these terrible things to happen to me? Well, the things themselves are evil, There is an evil one who's coming against me. But how come God allowed it? Because he intended it for good. Do you dare to believe that God is with you no matter what your circumstances? And no matter what others may try to do and even get away with doing, God intends it for good. Let's bow our heads together. Father God, give me the courage, the faith, the will to dare to see your hand in my life in such a way, and to allow you to move in blessing no matter what the circumstances. I pray that for each of my brothers and sisters, for Christ's sake. Amen.